This is audiobook of Encounter in the Pleiades, an inside look at UFOs. By Preston B. Nichols and Peter Moon. Book found online. This book is dedicated to Robert Lee Nichols. Introduction, by Peter Moon. In 1986, Preston Nichols shocked and dismayed the United States intelligence community when he publicly announced to a group of approximately 300 people in Chicago his role in a secret black project held on Long Island, officially known as the Phoenix Project. To intelligence and military circles, this activity has become colloquially known as the Montauk Project, named after the location of the project, which was at Montauk, New York, and is the subject of a popular book entitled The Montauk Project, Experiments in Time by Preston Nichols, with Peter Moon. This book, for which Mr. Nichols is most famous, chronicled major events which involved secret sciences such as weather control and mind control. Allegedly, these developments led to full-scale teleportation and materialization of objects, which in turn led to the harnessing of time itself. After publication of The Montauk Project, investigation continued in an effort to substantiate such claims. This ultimately resulted in two subsequent books, Montauk Revisited and Pyramids of Montauk, which corroborate that something of a very irregular nature did occur at Montauk and does so to this day. There are still more people coming forward that will attest to the reality of such a project. Although Preston's research has been hailed by many and condemned by others, no one can deny that he possesses a mastery of electromagnetic technology and has been involved in covert government research. His professional opinions and advice are still sought after in these circles. It is one aspect of Preston's connections to the secret sector which is to be the subject of this book, The Field of UFOs. Encounter in the Pleiades, an inside look at UFOs, is written in two parts. Part 1 is by Preston Nichols and concerns his intimate experiences with UFOs, aliens and their technology. It begins with Preston's personal encounters and how he boarded a UFO at the request of the military in an attempt to figure out how the vehicle was engineered. As the book continues, this secret is revealed in a step-by-step fashion that will leave you with a startling new look at reality and how UFOs function. Certain passages may get a little technical, but the language used is non-intimidating and easy to understand. There is plenty of adventure as well. The second part of this book is by myself, Peter Moon. I have served as Preston's ghostwriter for his first three books, and this work is our fourth collaboration together. Part 2 begins with my own ventures into the paranormal and how these inextricably linked me to Preston Nichols and the UFO phenomena. I conclude by digging into the mythology of the Pleiades and demonstrating how these stars serve as a gateway to anyone trying to understand the phenomena of inner and outer space. Encounter in the Pleiades, an inside look at UFOs, will take you on an unprecedented journey in consciousness into the inner realm of the UFO phenomena. After you read this book, you will never look at the subject of flying saucers in quite the same way. Happy reading. Part 1, by Preston B. Nichols. Chapter 1, UFOs, A General History. Unidentified flying objects or UFOs have been around in different forms ever since the dawn of man. Mysterious flying crafts are mentioned in old Sanskrit manuscripts as well as the Bible. There is Ezekiel's winged fire chariot in the Old Testament and a host of other descriptions if you wish to seek them out in ancient literature. They are nothing new to the experience of mankind, but an understanding as regards their precise nature certainly needs to be improved upon. That is the premise of this book. Modern-day ufology begins in a popular sense in 1947 with Kenneth Arnold's sightings in the Northwest and the crash in Roswell, New Mexico. The Roswell crash is particularly well documented and has been reported on in different books and a cable television movie. Although these events were reported on in the common press, earlier sightings were not so well known. In this respect, modern ufology began at least in the 1930s. The earliest sighting I've personally been told of was in 1936. This date, by no coincidence, is when the military was conducting its first experiments with radar. They could for the first time look at an unidentified object in the sky and see by looking at the radar screen that it had actual substance and was not of an illusory nature. This was the first hard scientific proof. At that particular time period, UFOs were referred to as flying unknowns, but for some reason the abbreviation FU didn't stick. Modern rumors of UFO crashes started roughly in 1936 and continued right through World War II until the first documented crash at Roswell in 1947. Since that time period, crashes began to occur at a rate of about one every 3 or 4 months. This is why the Air Force began Project Blue Book, which was at least a two-layered project. The first priority was for the Air Force to seek out and discover all information concerning UFO sightings and crashes. This came under the heading of military intelligence gathering. It vitally concerned the security of the nation. The second priority was to cover up the information and keep it out of the hands of potential enemies. This included keeping it out of the hands of the general public. In addition to keeping the information out of the public eye for national security reasons, there was another psychological concern. The military thought that a national panic might ensue, which could have unknown and possibly disastrous consequences. The 1939 broadcast of War of the Worlds proved that masses of people could react quite badly to the news of aliens arriving on planet Earth. In that specific case, people across the state of New Jersey began to barricade, flee and just generally panic when a radio broadcast of H.G. Wells' famous book announced that the Martians had landed. This was neither a prank by the station nor from Orson Welles, who narrated the story. The broadcast was fully described beforehand as the reading of a famous book. There is an even deeper anthropological implication as to why the government is so concerned and easily upset over the subject of UFOs. If you talk to the average person on the street and ask them where God is, many will point to the sky and answer that God is up there. If a very advanced culture suddenly arrived in a spaceship, large portions of the population would more than likely begin to worship the people in the spaceships as angels and believe they were ambassadors from God. With all the different religious sects forming around these beings from the stars, the government would lose control. All in all, what may have started out as a valid political concern developed into a control issue. Many people would dispute that it was a control issue all along. In any case, publicly elected officials did not make the information known to the public, assuming they were even told about it in the first place. The information on UFOs thus became reserved only for a power elite. While this power elite may have various motivations for keeping things secret, it is obvious that leaks have occurred and that disinformation has been circulated so as to keep the public confused and manipulated. My information comes from my own experiences. I am a professional engineer and understand all aspects of radar. I have known people who grew up in the industry and have heard countless stories. Some of the stories I have heard could be considered leaks, and others are just information passed on by logical deduction. This is the background against which I will relay my story. I will start by telling my own personal experiences with UFOs, beginning with childhood. Chapter 2, UFO Encounters. My first paranormal experience was as a child of about 5 or 6 years old. I woke up and saw what I believed to be the face of God looking in the doorway at me. This face definitely did not belong to either of my parents. It was very light-skinned and was surrounded with long white hair. Although I encountered this face many times, I do not recall any other unusual experiences until I was in my teens. I still do not know if the face I perceived was directly related to my later involvement with UFOs. It was either in 1961 or 1962, at the age of 15 or 16, that I saw my first UFO. Just prior to that time period, my parents had built me a small red shack in the far corner of our backyard. I was an electronics nut and they wanted to get me and my toys out of the house. As I conducted my experiments, they claimed I was making some of the most blood-curdling noises they had ever heard. Of course, in those days I had not yet learned how to properly install the negative feedback of an audio amplifier. If it is done incorrectly, there is screaming and howling that sounds like a banshee. It took me a while to understand why. It turned out all I had to do to stop the squealing was to reverse the leads on the output transformers, but until I figured that out, the amplifier must have squealed for a week. By building me a shed, my folks let me continue my hobby but at the same time ensured that I was as far away from the house as possible. It was no time before I had the place filled with radio receivers and a couple of old television sets. I even had some test equipment that looked like it belonged in Marconi's laboratory. As I had more test equipment than all my other classmates put together, I figured I was having a good old time as a high school kid. While tinkering in my lab one night, I couldn't get anything on the radio receivers but a strange humming noise. It kept coming over my radio receivers. Suddenly, I lost all power and the lights went dark. I soon went outside and witnessed a glowing disc-shaped object about 200 feet off the ground hovering over my front yard. I estimated the width at 50 feet and the height to be maybe 20 feet. Its color was bright white. All of a sudden and at once, the disc passed right over my head and took off. It moved upward then proceeded to make a few impossible maneuvers before going straight up again. I also noticed that the lights in my house and the entire neighborhood had been blacked out. After a while, the lights came back on. The next thing I noticed was my mother running out of the house. She was all excited and said, "Did you see that? Did you see that?" "Sure, Mom, I saw that," I answered. "Do you know what that was?" she said. "I don't know. It looked like a flying saucer to me." She told me that whatever it was had wiped out the television. I then told her that the radios in my shop had ceased to work as well. This particular experience was my first close encounter of the first kind. This is a popular term in ufology that refers to one seeing a UFO. A close encounter of the second kind is when you actually see the UFO land while being in the immediate vicinity. A close encounter of the third kind is when you are either taken aboard or have communication with aliens. Sometimes an abduction experience is referred to as a close encounter of the fourth kind. The UFO sighting in my backyard turned out to be the first of many. Around this general time period, early 1960s, there were a lot of UFO sightings around the area of Illip, the town on Long Island where I grew up and still live to this day. One day, which I recall to be in 1964, I was with a group of kids in high school. The next thing I knew, the school was emptying out with all the students running outside. Out on the ball field behind the school, there was a boomerang-shaped craft doing some sort of flying maneuvers. It was very odd and seemed to be only about 4 feet in diameter. I'm still not sure exactly what it was, but it suddenly took off. That was my second encounter with a UFO. Sightings occurred frequently when I entered Suffolk Community College in Selden. In fact, students all over campus witnessed UFOs en masse. As I was part of the electrical technology department and had a considerable knowledge of radio, I decided to make it a little more interesting and set up all sorts of spectrum analyzers, radio receivers, and cameras. This did the trick. One night we actually recorded film of UFOs in the sky. They were very clear pictures and anyone who stayed up late at night with me was able to witness the sightings firsthand. This was all extracurricular activity and was not treated with security measures of any kind. Consequently, when I came in the next morning to take out the footage, I was disappointed to discover that all the film had been taken from the cameras. It turned out that someone at the college had reported our activity. The result was that we began to be scrutinized by some sort of government authority. When we obtained the pay dirt, they were quick to move in and confiscate our evidence. Despite the shortcomings of our filming efforts, I did make progress in another area. This period at the college was the first time I had the opportunity to analyze the electromagnetic waves or signatures that these saucer objects generate. What I learned from this research was how to recognize UFOs. These crafts make very distinctive interference on shortwave radios and also in the VHF and UHF bands. The spectrum displays usually look like a hill. I learned to recognize them mainly by the sound that comes out of the speakers while in the AM detection mode when the AGC, automatic gain control, is turned off. They sound like a hum, buzz or a whistle under such conditions. There are also certain patterns in the background noise you can pick up. I became pretty good at recognizing them and now do it primarily by listening through headphones. All of this was very interesting but was strictly extracurricular to my schoolwork. As events developed, I ended up getting involved in other businesses and projects. Most notable was a rather bizarre anti-gravity project which ended in commercial failure and was abandoned after pressure was put on me. All in all, it wasn't until about 1974 that I would have another dramatic encounter with a UFO. Chapter 3, Aboard a UFO. During most of the 1970s, I was working for a major defense contractor on Long Island. It was in 1974 or 75 when my boss told me that I was selected to be part of a special crew that would be examining some foreign technology located at an unspecified US Air Force base. I figured we were going to look at either Russian or Chinese technology and mentioned that I would be happy to go along. I was then soberly informed that the assignment was not voluntary. I had to go. There were six of us who boarded an airplane which flew out of Republic Field on Long Island. We flew for a while and then landed. Looking from the air, I figured that we were going to Ohio. As soon as we hit ground and before we could possibly disembark, the pilot taxied along the runway and immediately went into a hangar. We were then shuttled from the plane into the back of a van with no windows. After being driven around for 2 or 3 hours, we had no idea where we could possibly be. Eventually, the van stopped and the back doors were opened. We emerged into some sort of underground hangar that was entirely empty. There was no wind or any other descriptive features to this facility, only doors that opened and closed. From one opening, you could see a corridor. We were taken down this corridor and sent to security where we were given a security briefing. I have said that there were six of us in total. One was my boss, but neither he nor the others remember too much of what went on. The briefing was done by Air Force personnel who were easily distinguished by their uniforms. My boss engaged in some rather lengthy dialogues with them. Finally, after being briefed on various security factors, we were taken into another hangar where we saw a disc-shaped UFO. I looked at one of the Air Force personnel and said, "Hey, that's a UFO." The airman said, "SHHH, we're not supposed to say things like that. It's a foreign aircraft." He then told us that we were visiting the Foreign Aircraft Technology Group. It was obviously a very clever use of language. The Air Force personnel representing the Foreign Aircraft Technology Group then proceeded to give us a grand tour of the UFO. From the outside, the craft was silver and looked just like a typical disc-shaped flying saucer. It appeared to be about 50 feet in diameter and 20 feet in height. There was also a dome on top that was maybe 15 feet wide. The entire craft stood on three legs that came out from the bottom. A ramp went up from the ground to a doorway on the edge of the craft. The most startling aspect of this flying saucer was apparent when I first went aboard. It was absolutely huge inside. The vessel was only 50 feet in diameter, yet we walked in one direction for what seemed to be 10 minutes. There was literally hundreds or thousands of feet of space. I couldn't explain it at the time. By today's knowledge, it is apparent that we had entered an artificial reality when boarding the ship. This aspect of a UFO is key to its construction and ability to travel from one location to another. It will be elaborated on later. Although I have said we were walking through an artificial reality, it was just as real as the environment or room you are sitting in now. The next point of interest I observed was that there were no controls anywhere to be seen. No buttons, levers or knobs. As we walked down the corridor from compartment to compartment, the lights would come on just before we arrived. I looked behind our path and noticed that the lights went off as we left an area. The lighting was very tightly controlled. As we continued to inspect the craft, one of the Air Force crew informed us that the saucer originally contained an odd atmosphere but that it had been retrofitted so that the atmosphere was compatible with human beings. We eventually came to a compartment that was identified as the control room. The most prominent part of this area were three lounge chairs placed in the front. By lounge chairs, I mean exactly that. They were designed for reclining comfort. A group of smaller chairs were in the back. Our group was then informed that the lounge chairs contained all sorts of coils, wires and other items. It was quite apparent that when a person or creature was reclined in the lounge chair, it was designed to pick the thoughts right out of their head. Readers of the Montauk Project, Experiments in Time will note that this technology is hauntingly familiar to that of the Montauk chair. On the walls, in front of the lounge chairs, were four view screens. These were also connected to the operator's thought processes. Sitting in the chair, one could call up different maps, star charts, or photographs from outside the craft. Just by thinking the thought, one could view what was outside the craft in any direction. Behind the view screens there was another small room that had a huge cluster of rock crystals. Coils spiraled around the crystals, which were connected at various points by wiring. The walls in this room were nothing but view screens. There were no windows here or in any other portion of the craft. We were then taken one level above the control area. This was the crew's living quarters. In addition to normal creature comforts, this level contained laboratories and a big medical facility. The laboratories contained large tables possibly used for experimentation upon humans. Down below the control room, at the very bottom of the saucer, there was one huge room filled with different rock clusters which were all interconnected with wires. Neither myself nor my co-workers recognized anything in the room except for the wiring, which was very neat. It appeared to be mostly gold, silver and platinum. We were told that it did not have much copper in it. Off this bigger rock room were four smaller rooms which connected to four hemispherical pods that sat below the center of the ship. Those pods each contained an assortment of what appeared to be antennas. The bottom section of the saucer was insulated from the rest of the craft and was surrounded by a huge coil. This coil was really just a lot of turns of heavy wire and was similar to a degaussing coil used for television sets. The huge coil was connected to the large group of crystals in the central room, which appeared to be the central core of energy. This is essentially how the ship was constructed. From the technology I observed, it was apparent that this craft's drive derived from electromagnetic principles. The four pods contained antennas which generated an electric field. The magnetic field was supplied by the electric coil mentioned above. I will give a more detailed description later on. As part of our research, the coils on the saucer were activated and we put voltmeters on the wires so that we could measure the different voltages. We also observed alternating currents, various waveforms and different frequencies. The craft was levitated about 10 to 20 feet off of the hangar floor so that we could do further experimentation and tests. All sorts of antennas and very sophisticated electronic equipment had been set up, and some of it was quite unique. I had never seen it before and still haven't to this day, save for this particular instance. There were signature analyzers, spectrum analyzers, and very advanced computers. Based upon my first-hand observations and the theories generated by our group, there had to be some sort of technical reality engineering system in it. What do I mean by reality engineering? Exactly that. I'm referring to the concept of building or creating a reality. If reality is defined as an agreed-upon system of perception and interaction that conforms to certain rules, reality engineering refers to changing that system. Or, more importantly, it refers to creating a different system that can interface with the original system or reality. I know that if I were building a spacecraft, I wouldn't want to rely on a ship that artificially, by machine, maintains a huge space inside of a small ship. If the machines were to fail, everything could crunch together and perhaps disappear. It could be a nightmare. If I were to do it, I would want a passive system. There would be no electricity and no power. By virtue of the physical shaped structure of the craft I had seen, an alternate reality would have to have been created on the inside. How to accomplish such a feat is another matter entirely, and that aspect will be discussed later on. After working with my engineering team, I concluded there was a single system behind the controls that used the three chairs to pick up commands from the beings in the chairs. The cluster of crystals behind the control room was a computer. The larger cluster of crystals on the lower deck, along with the antenna arrays, all within a coil around the base, I identified as a space-time reality generator. It was a self contained system and appears to be a simple setup. After returning to my job on Long Island, there was no mention of the flying saucer field trip by any of my co-workers. It was a confidential matter and was not to be talked about. When I finally did ask my colleagues, they had no recollection. At the same time, I was having memory problems of my own. I was living a buried life that I didn't have full recognition of until years later. It was in this other life that I was able to witness another UFO. This one happened to be in the underground facility at Montauk. In my buried life, I was working at both Brookhaven Labs and on the Montauk project and saw this craft during a work assignment. This saucer was more oval-shaped than the one from Wright-Patterson that I have already described. It had the same screens and chairs, but there were also knobs and buttons in addition to a different number of operating systems. I wasn't involved in reverse engineering this craft, but it was assigned only to help disassemble the different systems as well as the ship itself. The craft came apart in sections, which is similar to reports that have circulated about the ships of the Grey Aliens. In both of these sources that I witnessed up close, the hull appeared to be an entire unit in itself. As we disassembled the craft at Montauk, I thought I saw a control system, a computer system and some sort of drive, but I was never able to figure out exactly what they were. There was also a radio room of some sort. It is obvious that this vehicle was not being operated under one cohesive engineering system like the one discussed previously. This saucer was never fired up, but I am not sure why. Perhaps they couldn't operate it or didn't know how. It is obvious to me from what I have personally experienced that the UFO at Wright-Patterson was the most advanced form available and could be considered the Cadillac of flying saucers. The only thing more advanced would be a purely spiritual vehicle. I will go deeper into the technical aspects of this state of their art flying saucer, but first we will examine my next personal encounter with a UFO. Chapter 4, UFO Torpedo Man. My next encounter was in 1989, not too long before I was terminated from employment at the BJM company. BJM had been contracted by the government to build a special UHF transmitter and had done a pretty bad job of it. It had been constructed out of very modern avant-garde technology that simply didn't work. As I had a reputation for putting together technology for spook projects, they decided to turn the job over to me. After being given the assignment, I picked up the phone immediately and spoke to the customer, who told me that he required a pulse-modulated transmitter that transmitted at a specific frequency. The information on the exact frequency is still classified. I told him what he needed was a tube transmitter, not a solid-state configuration. After we spoke, I went through the warehouse at BJM and picked out an old airport transmitter that would put out about 500 watts of RF, radio frequency, in the UHF region. I dusted it off, fixed it up and got it operating to the customer's specifications. It was frequency pulse modulated and ran in the upper UHF band. After it was finished, we took a small helical antenna structure and mounted it on a tripod. Soon after, I was told to take the transmitter and drive it down to Fort Meade. I signed it out, put it in the back of my Dodge Caravan and made the 5-hour drive down to Maryland. Upon arriving at Fort Meade, I was surprised at the lax security. After identifying myself, they simply said that they knew who I was and that I could go down to Hangar 6A or some such designation. Two men from the government soon joined me. I was told to set up the equipment and wait. One of the guys with me had a walkie-talkie. He got hold of somebody and began to talk into it. "We're ready," he said. Guess what I saw next? A small flying saucer approached until it was right in front of us. As soon as it reached us, it began to turn around. After being so instructed, I turned on the transmitter I'd brought with me and the saucer suddenly became unstable. It began to wobble and make strange noises. One of the men then said, "Shut it off. It works." They then told me to take the transmitter back to the plant at BJM and let it sit there. I went back and told my boss. He said that I could just put it on the back bench in my workspace for the time being. About 2 months after my trip to Maryland, I kept hearing that the satellite receiver group at BJM was working on some new equipment. According to the reports I was getting, they were tracking UFOs via satellites.